Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Texas leads the nation this week, 93%, very short to short, closely followed by Louisiana at 88%. Matching that is Washington State in the Northwest, coming in at 88%, very short to short. Not too far down further is Montana at 82%, very short to short.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
As we try to finish out the crop season in the Western Corn Belt, quite a few dry states there. We've got numbers at or above 60%, very short to short in Iowa and Minnesota. And then also, as we have the hurricane moving into the southeast, it is probably a bit fortunate that there are some dry conditions that have developed in parts of the southeast. We actually see numbers greater than 50%, very short to short, on August 27th in states like Georgia and South Carolina.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Since the last Farm Bill, we have made historic investments to address the unique challenges faced by these communities across the country.
At a Farm Bill hearing earlier this year, Senate Ag Committee Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow from Michigan.
New funding for programs like ReConnect is improving rural America's access to affordable high-speed internet, creating new opportunities to connect people to jobs and education and healthcare. Historic investments in affordable clean energy and energy efficiency upgrades are working to lower costs and create new good-paying jobs in our communities. We've also made progress to address the climate crisis by providing historic investments in long-standing, voluntary, and flexible Farm Bill conservation programs. For years, these popular bipartisan programs have been oversubscribed and underfunded. New funding for the programs like EQIP, RCPP, are allowing us to finally address the backlog of initiatives and strengthen these programs. We also know that our farmers are facing traditional and novel challenges. While USDA projects that net farm income will remain above the 20-year average, and many commodity prices are at historic highs, so too are land, fertilizer, and other input costs. This is making it challenging for our producers to maintain their operations. Since the last Farm Bill, farmers received $70 billion in assistance outside of Farm Bill programs, including over $13 billion in response to weather and climate disasters. They have devastated crops, forests, and livestock. This is why I will continue to fight to expand and strengthen crop insurance and the Farm Bill disaster assistance programs for all our farmers. The future of our food systems rely on the investments we make today. The 2018 Farm Bill included strong investments in agricultural research, which helps our farmers develop the tools they need in the face of the climate crisis and other emerging challenges. These investments, as well as Farm Bill programs that support the next generation of farmers and agricultural producers, are critical to the long-term success of American agriculture. We must ensure that the Farm Bill continues to support the nutrition programs that serve as a lifeline to millions of people and families across the country. The SNAP program provides food assistance for more than 41 million Americans, 80% of which are children, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. The bipartisan 2018 Farm Bill directed a long overdue reevaluation of the Thrifty Food Plan, which had not been done since 1975, almost 50 years ago. This update resulted in a very modest increase to the average SNAP benefit of about $1.35 a day, an increase estimated to lift 2.4 million people, including a million children, out of poverty. Spending on nutrition programs does not rob resources from other Farm Bill programs, just as crop insurance doesn't rob resources from other programs when disasters hit and spending goes up. But threats that we are hearing from some, certainly not agricultural leaders, but some in the House, of reckless mandatory budget cuts will result in cuts to all Farm Bill programs, and I know that's something that no one in this committee wants. We cannot go backward at a time when our farmers and our families are counting on us to move forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I really think we need to all reflect on where we've come from and where we have the same foundation. As we think about the information we'll share, I want to remind you all that even though this last year was our peak in slaughter and peak in production, this would have occurred 2 years ago had it not been for COVID.
Earlier this year at the Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar, Randy Block, CEO of Cattle Facts, on where we've been and where we're going.
We were slated to be at our cyclical peak in supply in 2020 and occurred in 2022. So I remind you of that because, again, we all have talked about leverage over the course of the last couple of years. We've gone through a significant leverage shift from both ways. Again, where the cattle feeders, the cattle industry had tremendous amount of leverage on the harvesting and retail sectors in 2013 and 14 and 15. And then that went the other direction as we shut down packing plants, et cetera. And now we're back moving back into balance in here between our available supplies and harvest capacity. So our staff will go into more detail on that today. We're obviously a lot more current. We do have economic headwinds, which Mike Murphy will walk us through today. Give us some of those things to have on your radar screen. We've had significant shipping bottlenecks, as you know, not only in our industry, but in all industries as we think about the implications of COVID. Most of those have been largely handled now. So some of these significant backlogs, as you remember, a year ago, we had 500, 600, 700 ships that we couldn't get unloaded. We couldn't move product out of the country. We couldn't bring product in. Those have been largely taken care of. So that's been good. We'll talk to you a little bit about interest rates, costs there. Obviously, they've gone up significantly. Mike will give you the outlook on that. And I remind you all that cattle prices have moved significantly in here over the course of the last, since the COVID lows. I think sometimes we forget about that. The Fed cattle prices have moved about $62 a hundred higher since we made the COVID lows in the spring of 2020. And of course, calf and feeder cattle prices have moved as well, but look how close the spreads are and how much prices moved. What's the other ingredient? Cost, isn't it? Corn prices have moved sharply higher. Obviously, hay prices, all of those things have moved to where the price spreads or the price advances have been more limited on feeder cattle and calves. Well, that's going to change, and our staff will walk you through some of those things that you need to be prepared for as we go forward. Obviously, I think the thing that has had the biggest impact on our business over the course of the last several years now has been drought. It's been drought. You think about the entire western part of the United States, the Southwest, the Central and Southern Plains regions, the Corn Belt, particularly the Western Corn Belt in this last year, the impact that it had on grain production. Most importantly, as we think about what happened, is the significant downsizing in the nation's cow herd. Cow herd is substantially smaller on January 1 of 2023 than what we told you it would be on January 1 of 2022 because the drought had lingered on so in so much detail.
Randy Block is CEO of Cattle Facts, and this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Two things that we focus on, and I don't think they've changed really from 1 year to the next in the last 2 years. If we don't have a functioning supply chain and a reliable water supply, there's almost no point to anything else that we're doing.
Aubrey Betancourt is CEO of the Almond Alliance.
So those are our tier one priorities when it comes to almond farming in California and in the United States. So as we look at that, we've had an interesting change, and this is typical of the irrigated West. Here we are on a Mediterranean climate. That's what allows us to grow almonds the way we do. But that means we get our rain and snow in the winter, and then that sustains us through the drier summer months. We don't get rain in the summer like you do in other parts of the country. And so the ability to capture, store, and move that water reliably is what has made California one of the largest ag economies in the world, and what has allowed the almond industry specifically to become the size and scale that it is and to be sustained as such. When we have various regulatory challenges or actual challenges from years of drought that have allowed that system to not function in the way that it's supposed to, our reservoirs and our canals, it leaves us at a deficit. And it leaves us having to kind of get ourselves out of that. So when we get into a year like this, where we have abundant snow and abundant rain, 9 atmospheric rivers hitting us at the same time, it's about using that existing system and making sure the policies and the regulations that administer that system allow us to capture, store, and move that water for the time of dry and to recover our aquifers so that we can replenish that system and keep us in kind of this holistic, what I call total portfolio water management. And so we're really pushing in this space where we have a water supply structure and laws that are very out of date, trying to keep up with our modern technology and our modern demand and our modern relationship to the resource. So we're really working with state and federal officials to modernize not only the infrastructure itself, but also the policies that administer it to allow for more reliable water supply. And true climate resilience is the ability to deliver water and the ability to protect from flood, and that's what the system's designed to do. So we need to update that to keep up with our new challenges and changes.
And earlier this year, focused on supply chain issues.
A year ago, we had a lot of product that was sold here in the United States, over 900 million pounds. To put that into scale, we produce anywhere from 2.6 to 3 billion pounds a year. We had almost 940 million pounds that we had sold but couldn't move. And our season starts August 1, so we had a short window to get this product off our shores. Why is that a crisis for us? Because our farmers don't get paid until that product gets delivered. And so we were facing a total socioeconomic tragedy if we couldn't get that product off our shores. Through some interesting dynamics, opening up new channels, what we call a multimodal, multi-port strategy, where before we sent almost 80% of our ag product out of the Port of Oakland, we decided, well, let's meet the boats where they are. If they aren't going to come to Oakland and pick up our product, let's go down to L.A. and get on the boat there. Let's go out to Houston and get on the boat there. Let's go out to Norfolk and Savannah and Newark and get on the boat there. Well, how are we going to get there? Well, now we go multimodal. Okay, trucks are great. How about rail? We partnered with the Union Pacific, started moving product in containers around to get them closer to our farms, away from the congestion at the ports, and get our product out through other avenues and channels. We were able to move a lot of that product. We had some issues with port strikes and some labor issues that maybe have slowed us down a little bit. But now we have more of what I call Legos on the table. So this year we do have a lot of crops sitting again, about 800 million pounds that we need to move. That being said, we're ahead of the game, and we have new partners, and we have new strategy. So we feel a little bit more confident in the ability to move the product, but this year the global market's different. And so now trade is rising as a higher priority for us. And so the ability to sell product when the dollar is so strong as an export crop is a little difficult. But our industry, I would tell you, they're resilient. They know these are tough times, and we're just going to need to keep moving product in order for us to get through this phase. Same as the water. We got to get through the drought to get to the flood so we can get into the next phase and right size and keep moving forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I know everyone in this room has heard me say this before, but based on the last census, 53 of 75 counties in Arkansas have lost population. That is 71% of Arkansas counties.
At a farm bill hearing earlier this year, ranking member, Senate Ag Committee, Dr. John Bozeman from Arkansas.
Across the United States, 53% of our counties, or 1,660 out of 3,140, lost population in the last census. I'm certain that all my colleagues on this committee are concerned about the hollowing out of our states and our country and the impact that this will have on the future of America. I know this has been a major theme of yours, as you've talked across America in the last 2 years. At the end of this farm bill process, I would like to go back to rural Arkansans and tell them that we put policies and programs in place that will improve their quality of life and give their children and their neighbors' children reason to return home. In my mind, ensuring this country has a vibrant and economically sustainable agriculture economy is key to accomplishing that goal. The headwinds for our producers are great. For only the third time in 55 years, we're expected to have a trade deficit in agriculture, and no two trade deals have been signed or are under negotiation. This will be the most expensive crop on record at $460 billion and follow last year's previous record of more than $440 billion. Farm debt is over half a trillion at $535 billion. Input costs are still high. Supply chains are easing but remain tight. Interest rates have rapidly increased and by percentage represent the largest cost increase our producers will face this year. Farm production costs have increased 28% or nearly $90 billion. Many do not understand the amount of capital required to farm these days. During the fiscal year 2022, the average size of the Farm Service Agency's guaranteed operating loans, often used for our young and beginning farmers and ranchers, was nearly $330,000. The capital cost of getting into agriculture is enormous, and farmers are going to have to rely more heavily on credit this year. How many other jobs require that you take out the loan the size of a mortgage or larger each year? And in order to pay that back, you must contend with the weather, the markets, the economy, and global politics. These are many of the reasons why when I meet with my farmers, they all tell me the safety net is badly frayed and needs to be reinforced. The 2014 Farm Bill was successful in moving agriculture away from direct payments to need-based support during times of low prices or low revenue. That was nearly a decade ago, and farm programs have not kept pace with the needs of modern agriculture and are not responsive in the face of pandemics or geopolitical pressures. The current safety net does not reflect the current levels of risk taken on each year by those that provide the food, fiber, and fuel we depend on. As we address these risks, it's critical that we not get consumed by a small farm versus big farm conflict. While 89% of the farms in the U.S. are classified as small by USDA and contribute nearly 18% of farm production, there are 3.2% of farms classified as large that contribute 46.5% of our nation's farm production. All farms are valuable. This farm bill will not neglect the small nor punish the large. We must also acknowledge that programs within this farm bill that relate to trade promotion, research, basic infrastructure in rural communities, bolstering the infrastructure to protect our flocks and herds, and so many other important programs must be considered. This farm bill covers much more than simply conservation, nutrition, and green energy, which have received a $300 billion windfall since the last farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Now, as you kind of look at that interest rate line there, that blue line, and basically we've seen rates double from where we had been the most of the previous decade.
Mike Murphy is with Cattle Facts.
If we were looking at like a impact on a feeder animal, so a 1,400-pound steer, 25% equity on that animal, you know, basically you're doubling the interest cost from like 20 to 40 bucks. That's what it means from a feeding margin standpoint, and that's only on the cattle side. Now, think about it from somebody that's looking to purchase bred females. $2,000 bred female, 25% equity. Same concept. You're doubling that interest cost going from, you know, 50, 60 to 100, 120 right in that area. So these are potential headwinds is when Kevin comes out and starts to talk about the impact of these types of things from an interest rate standpoint and what that impact might be on the price forecast in here for the remainder of this year. We've got to keep those things in mind.
Speaking earlier this year at the Cattle Facts Outlook seminar about inflation and also personal savings and unemployment.
There's no doubt that inflation for the average consumer has had a huge impact on us. And I think this slide, when you start to look at that personal savings rate, is the one that really illustrates it the best. We have drawn down all of our savings. Now, clearly, we were felt the lift from all of these subsidies that we received coming through that COVID era, but we've drained this down and now we're at the lowest personal savings rate since 2008 and 2009. We're just not at a spot yet where wages are increasing enough to be able to help compensate the increase in inflation to get the average consumer back onto the savings track. And we don't believe that's going to take place in 2023. This is going to stay more leveling off in here as we go through the remainder of the year, close to 5%, but certainly not increasing at any point in time. From our perspective, this is a caution flag in terms of demand for beef from the consumer. Not a warning flag, but a caution flag. Now, you would look back at this and say, well, historically, if we go back to that 2008-09 time frame where we had a very adverse impact on beef demand, you know, what's different this time around? And it really comes down to unemployment. We are really very well employed from a consumer's perspective. We're all still sitting in here as an average consumer where we have jobs. And if we have jobs, we feel good about our situation, even though financially we're feeling that tightness, but we're employed. And so from our standpoint, we feel like that will transfer over to be supportive to beef demand. Now, there's always those concerns where you get the roll-down effect going from potentially beef to pork to poultry, something like that. And we have to watch that very closely as we go through the year. But overall, we feel pretty good about where we are from a beef demand standpoint because of the fact that we're employed. Now, will unemployment rate increase throughout the year? For sure. We believe it could get towards 5.25% by the end of the year, which, as you look at this historically, will still be a very low number going back over the course of the last 50 years. The other thing that we got to remember is that we're going through a major cycle in here where the baby boomers are retiring. And the next generation is a smaller generation to enter the workforce. And some economists would suggest that it's a 400,000 number difference every single year. And that's really going to create a situation that we've got, plenty of jobs out there, but we don't have enough people to necessarily fill those jobs. So we're not as concerned about things economically from an employment perspective as we look in here towards the tail end of the year.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What stands out to everybody are the food assistance or SNAP outlays. That has grown substantially since 2008 in the Great Recession.
Farm policy expert and former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency, Jonathan Kappas.
Of course, the pandemic will have also impacted this, and so we will see an increase in that in the CBO baseline. Sometimes what we get lost in these big numbers are the realities of these two programs. And we are serving roughly above 40 million Americans who are low income, who are struggling to put food on the table. And the SNAP program provides them direct assistance to purchase food and to help them manage that series of challenges at the household and individual level. So it isn't, if all we do is look at the dollars, we tend to over-focus on SNAP as a blunt amount of spending. But when you think about the number of people who are being helped by this and being helped to purchase food, I think it puts that program in a different context.
But he also outlines why the current 2018 Farm Bill is so unique.
The 2018 Farm Bill has nearly run out its five-year life, but this Farm Bill's existence has been rather unusual in terms of Farm Bill history and expectations. This chart before you is a comparison of what was spent, 2022 forecast to be spent under the farm programs, that's the Navy bars, and then the supplemental and ad hoc programs that have kicked in since 2018 with the Market Facilitation Program in 18 and 19, and then, of course, the coronavirus response programs and payments in 2020 and 2021 and into 2022. And so this is unusual for multiple reasons. It is rare to, in fact, it's never happened that we've seen this level of ad hoc spending on farmers in addition to farm program payments. It is unusual for there to be multiple years of this. Typically, we'd see an ad hoc, in response to a drought or hurricane scenario, but to go through multiple programs over multiple years created using largely using the existing authorities and the Commodity Credit Corporation. It's pretty unusual to see that kind of year-over-year aspect. So almost the entire life of this Farm Bill has been shadowed by this ad hoc and supplemental spending. And then, the other side is it's just unusual for there to be that much more spending through an ad hoc system than the authorized programs. What does this mean for a 2023 Farm Bill debate? I think is one of the big questions we have before us and that the committees have before them in this discussion. For one thing, it is certainly challenging perspectives around what spending goes out to farmers and how the programs work and look to them. Particularly under the coronavirus assistance programs, we provided assistance to a much larger population of farmers, a much larger set of crops, fruit and vegetable crops, livestock, who don't typically get Title I program payments. How does that impact their decisions and their requests in a farm bill? And how does that play out given the baseline limitations we have? So I think this is kind of one of those, as we look at our roadmaps, this can be one of those challenging areas on the path, sorting this out and helping particularly some of the farmers and crops who don't typically get assistance but have seen it in recent years leading into this farm bill. This is something we'll be watching and looking to discuss as we go.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The REAP program, Rural Energy for America program, has been around for 15 years, but it's still going strong. And at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois, Wednesday.
Today we're announcing $266 million of REAP.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the new REAP loans and grants will translate into
1,334 investments across 47 states and two territories to help farmers lower their costs in terms of their own power needs and also potentially create more revenue on the farm.
On that score, Vilsack gave an example of a Rhode Island farm that used the REAP program to put in a renewable energy generation system.
And they're generating about $66,000 of additional income on their farm because they are basically selling excess power to their electric co-op that needs that power.
Since December of 22, USDA has made up to $1.3 billion available for REAP projects nationwide. Gary Crawford, Washington.